So here's a conundrum for parents. If you have kids, you get told over and over, limit their screen time. And you're also told, instead of screen time, get them reading more, which is all well and good, except that these days many children do their reading on a screen, which raises some interesting questions about how children read today and what direction things are headed in children's book publishing. To help us out, we've called Dan Poynter. He's the author of The Self-Publishing Manual and 126 other books. He says kids are still reading traditional printed books, but 13% of children's book sales are now e-books, and that number is rising.
And by the way, 11 million parents have purchased an e-book, and 19.6 million parents plan to buy an e-book, so the numbers are huge.
Which makes sense. Kids like to look at screens. But that's not the only reason e-books are flooding the market. They're also way cheaper to produce.
Printing and transporting paper is very expensive, and e-books eliminate the expensive four-color printing, the higher quality paper, the ocean shipping, the customs clearance, the inventory, answering the telephone, writing up the orders, picking, packing, and shipping, and managing all of these functions. So we eliminate a huge number of costs and the chance that those books won't sell.
All of that means Dan is not optimistic about the future of printed books.
Run a test. Give a five-year-old a printed book and an iPad and see what happens. That five-year-old is going to go right for the iPad. They're not intimidated by it. They know what to do with it. They'll start searching around. And in a children's e-book, you can have links to kids-safe encyclopedias. So if they click on the lion, it takes them to Africa and tells them all about lions. So now the e-book is educational.
Not all authors are embracing the new technology. One who is, wholeheartedly, is Roxy Monroe. She had written traditional children's books for years, mostly search and find books, maze books, that type thing. And then,
about 5 years ago, I got an email fan letter from a guy in the Netherlands who had a five-year-old son. And he loved the app book, the maze books. And about 18 months ago, I got an email from the fellow again, who owns a graphics company, and he wanted to dip his toes into apps and thought that my books would be perfect.
When you first saw, you know, your book that you were used to seeing as a printed book, when you first saw the electronic version, what did you think? What was your reaction?
I was just loved it. I mean, I just thought that that's what it should be, have been all along.
I want to ask you, we were taking a look here at one of the apps you have out. This is called Doors. It was originally a printed book that you created. And the printed book, I assume it was a kind of a lift-the-flap type book. You could open the door that way. Is that right?
Yes, paper engineered.
Lift the flaps and step through doors into wonderful worlds that you can explore.
That sizzling sound is the space shuttle door opening up. And then the door there opens up to the fire station.
Think of sirens. Think of red. Call the station, someone said. Find a flashlight and a glove. A first aid kit that's stored above.
You see a guy coming down a pole. A dog barks.
And look for a hat and an apple, too.
And the child's able to actually, they're moving their finger across the screen and picking where they want to go next and finding objects.
They can make the horn blow or the lights come out.
Now, Roxy admits not all children's books lend themselves to e-versions.
For example, studies have been done where if it's just a story and you're reading it, but some things are animated that aren't pertinent to the story and the child gets distracted just touching everything, they have found that they actually retain less of the story and read it less well.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, so it really depends upon the content and what the book is all about.
So might there be a future, even a bleak one, for old-fashioned printed kids' books?
Well, I don't think they're dead, but frankly, I think within one generation, maybe 30 years, very few houses will have bookshelves, and people will have libraries. A few people will have libraries just like they collect art or stamps or fine prints. So there'll be libraries, private libraries, and there'll be public libraries. But I don't think, sadly, that the average house will have a bookshelf in 30 years.
Which is sad, isn't it? I put the question to our publishing expert, Dan Poynter. Do you think anything is lost in this transition?
Well, sure, if you're a printer or a trucker.
if you're a kid or a parent. I mean, I would miss, for example, I have little kids, and I would miss some of the, I think some of the big colorful illustrations are hard to capture on a small screen, or some of the tactile things. Some of the, you know, you touch Pat the bunny and he feels furry. You can't do that on a screen.
You'll get over it.
My 5-year-old.
The kids love the iPad and the other large screen things. They're pretty good size.
Which brings us back around to the question I raised at the very beginning. I can't let you go without asking you to respond directly to this conundrum I raised. Parents are supposed to be limiting their kids' screen time. They're also supposed to be encouraging them to read. When those two are one and the same, what are you supposed to do?
There's good screen time and bad screen time. What if your 5-year-old, 6-year-old is just motivated and excited to read the encyclopedia? What's wrong with that?
Dan Pointer and author Roxy Monroe talking about the future of children's books. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly. In war-torn Congo, the heart of Africa, a convoy of private military contractors carrying a U.S. senator to a secret mine is about to run into trouble.
In the middle car, the package is still staring out of the window, a look of horror forming on his face. It's as though the anticipation has spread, as though it's a virus or a stain, alive somehow, crimson and thirsty. Ray swallows. He's thirsty himself, the feeling in his veins now inexorable, like a dark, slowly uncoiling sexual desire that senses imminent release. He puts his finger on the trigger.
That shooting is the first strand in a complicated web that makes up our book this week, the new thriller Bloodland. Author Alan Glynn, that's his voice you just heard, unfolds a story of corruption and murder and cover-ups. And Alan Glynn joins us now from Dublin. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Mary Louise.
So tell me, in just a few seconds, what's the book about?
The book is a political thriller, which takes us from Dublin via New York to the Congo. It deals with illegal mining of metals in the Congo and the relationship that they have to corporate boardrooms in New York. It's an exploration of the, if you like, the power dynamics that go on between these two things.
A lot of manipulation of power and shady backroom deals and all this. Well, I was so struck by, you do have all these kind of grand themes, as you just mentioned, but instead of, you know, lecturing about them from lofty heights, you really take it down to these, just, you have this great cast of quite seedy characters, people who are outwardly powerful but inwardly have their issues. Was that a deliberate way to tell the story?
Yeah, I think the danger with something like this is to be polemical. If you start with an agenda, a political agenda, in fiction, you're asking for trouble. It's important to kind of not preach, even though at the heart of the story there is a kind of a political point, I think. But what really interests me is the psychology of these people in these positions of power. And characters which, you know, on the surface, on the page, might seem extremely unsympathetic. I think by getting close to the way they think, there's a certain ambivalence that comes out, which is interesting.
Which character did you have the most fun writing?
I like James Vaughan, the character. He's a kind of a grey eminence, if you like, behind the book.
And he's the international financier, right? Kind
yes.
of a George Soros gone bad.
Yeah, he runs a private equity company called the Oberon Capital Group. He's a guy in his early 80s. He's been around for a long time. And I'm just fascinated by someone who's been so involved on so many levels of the power structures and the way the world has developed to today.
Without giving away any of the twists and turns in your book, it is safe to say that a lot of the characters here make very bad choices. That, you know, they land in trouble and it's entirely of their own making.
Yes, and then they make further choices which get them further into kind of knottier trouble spots, which is fun, I think, to fun to write, and it's fun to watch how they dig deeper into the hole that they're in.
Let me ask you to focus in on one of them, and this is the character Larry Bulger. He, until quite recently in your book, was Prime Minister of Ireland. He's now out of a job, and he's also an alcoholic who had not had a sip in a decade until now. And you have a great scene in there where you describe him in his living room. He's standing in front of his liquor cabinet. He's reached out and he's touching a bottle of whiskey. I wonder if you would read that passage for us, page 63.
Sure. He raises the glass to his lips and slurps whiskey. The taste of it, the feel of it going down. Oh, my God. He holds the glass in front of him, stares at it in disbelief, raises it to his lips again, takes a couple of genteel sips, just for confirmation. Already he can feel it, that burning sensation in his stomach. Already he can feel those familiar cravings, sudden and impatient. For a cigarette, for company, for another sip. He turns around and takes one.
One interesting thing, hearing you read that, it's all in the present tense. It's a little jarring because most fiction, you realize, is written in the past tense. Why did you choose to do it that way?
You say most fiction is in the past. I suppose it is, but there is a pretty good tradition of writing in the present tense. Thomas Pynchon's Gravity's Rainbow is written in the present tense. It's more immediate, and we're swept along, I think, with the events of the story in a more immediate way.
I'm speaking with Alan Glynn about his new thriller, Bloodland. And Alan Glynn, let me ask you about the character, your kind of protagonist, who's the one trying to unravel all of these various twists and turns, is a journalist named Jimmy. And you write, I mean, as a journalist reading this, I thought, wow, he kind of got it right. He gets how it works. Were you ever a journalist yourself?
Oh, well, thank you. That's good to hear because, no, I haven't been a journalist. I don't think I have what it takes to meet deadlines. I know journalists. I've spoken to some. And it also deals with the whole crisis that's going on at the moment in newspapers, with newspapers closing and all of that stuff. He's kind of bang in the middle of that. He's very young. He's not that experienced. And he's looking for a place in a news organization where he can, you know, do what he wants to do, which is follow a story.
Now, as this young reporter is trying to follow the story, the reader is following along with him, and that's how a lot of the plot twists in the book unfold. I am always fascinated when I speak to writers to find out, did you know what was going to happen? I mean, when you start writing a book like this, do you know how it's all going to end?
No, I don't. I don't really plan in great detail at all. I'm always reminded of that great quote by E.L. Doctorow. He said, writing a novel is like, you know, driving a car at night. You know, you can just see as far as the headlights will show you, but you can make the whole journey that way. And I think that keeps it fresh for the writer as well as the reader.
So you're getting to know the characters yourself as you write them on the page. Yeah.
It's kind of a tightrope walk in a way, too, because, you know, it's a confidence trick that you play on yourself as well as the reader. If you look down, you know, you can fall.
We've mentioned this. The action in this book is set largely in Dublin, where you live, and also action unfolds in New York, in Italy. But several of the key scenes are in Africa, in Congo, a place I'm assuming you have not personally lived in. How do you deal with that challenge of describing a place that you haven't yourself gotten to know very well?
I did a lot of research. And also the scenes in the Congo are filtered through characters who are not from there. And I think that helped me a bit, too.
You're not trying to write in the voice of an African. But on the other hand, it's fiction. I mean, you could make up whatever you want. How important is it to you to get it absolutely right?
Absolute 100% accuracy is not so important. I mean, I think James Joyce kind of, you know, flogged that horse to death, really. You know, when he wrote Ulysses, everything had to be inch perfect. Everything he described, he used to write home to his relatives to measure things in the street, you know. So I think once he did that, you know, it was left open after that for anybody to make it up as you go along. But you want to get it right to a certain extent.
Well, again, without wanting to give away any of the twists and turns that unfold on these pages, I think I can safely say that at the end of this one, it seems as though you're setting us up for an epic battle between two of the characters, or your reporter hero Jimmy and the wicked Jimmy Vaughn. Are we going to see these characters again?
Yes. The third novel it's kind of a loose trilogy, I've described it. The books could be read separately, but I think they will go together quite well. The third one is called Graveland. I deal with the character of James Vaughn in quite a lot of detail in this new book through his father, his grandfather, his great-grandfather, back as far as the 1870s and the railroads. It sounds pretty ambitious, but we'll see how it goes.
You've got your work cut out for you.
Absolutely.
Well, we'll look forward to that one. Alan Glynn, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mary Louise.
That's Alan Glynn talking about his latest novel, Bloodland, and we just spoke with him from the studios of RTE in Dublin. It's Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
The yeas are 293, the nays are 132.
The Congress did the right thing and voted to make sure the taxes would not go up on middle-class families at the end of this month.
This legislation is simply an election year gimmick.
It is amazing what happens when Congress focuses on doing the right thing instead of just playing politics.
President Obama and Republican Congressman Phil Gingrey on yesterday's passage of the payroll tax cut extension. James Fallows of The Atlantic joins us now, as he does most Saturdays, for a look behind the headlines. Hey, Jim.
Hello, Mary Louise.
So, as you know, Republicans in the House swore that they would never give up fighting against this tax cut extension. It ended up passing easily. What happened?
It certainly did. I guess the prospect of an impending election marvelously focuses the mind, as it does for House members every 2 years. This suggests that we may have seen, at least for the moment, the high water mark of the stop everything obstructionist spirit, which was what the Tea Party Republicans were largely elected for in the House. You recall that last summer we had this brinksmanship about raising the debt limit and a possible default on the national debt.
Which went on for weeks and weeks and weeks.
Indeed, yeah. And was solved only at the last moment. Then I think the next step was in December, when the Obama administration thought that the political winds had changed to be at its back, and that if it put the Republicans in the position of opposing an extension of the payroll tax cut, that would look bad. And I think the number of Republicans, including Senator McCain, said they just put themselves in an impossible position by saying no on too many things. So at least for now, they were willing to resolve this issue in more or less a normal fashion.
Moving along to politics of a different type, China's vice president, Xi Jinping, was in the U.S. this week. He may well be China's president by next year. So this was a closely watched visit. I gather he got a rather unexpected toast, almost a roast, from the U.S. Vice President Joe Biden. Jim, you were at the lunch where these two leaders were. What happened?
Yes, this was a gala event. It was co-hosted both by Vice President Biden and Secretary Clinton. And Biden, in the beginning of his toast, said what is normal in these sorts of events, which is the importance of long-term relationship, how valuable it was for both countries to have these 40 years of interaction since Richard Nixon's opening, et cetera, et cetera. And then he spent the second half of his remarks giving a very detailed list of the concerns and complaints the United States had, ranging from China's veto with Russia of the Syrian resolution of the United Nations towards intellectual property theft and currency valuation and things like that. In real time, Mr. Xi seemed somewhat taken aback. He had his own prepared toast, which was anodyne and positive, although the next day he did give a more substantive response about China's view on these same issues. But I think in perspective, it was an indication of the constancy of U.S.-China relations, where the United States has tried to say that on the one hand, it recognizes that it's better to be China's friend than its enemy, and it welcomes China's emergence. But on the other hand, there are a lot of areas where we really do deeply disagree.
Let's touch just briefly on some sad news from this week. The death in Syria of the New York Times reporter Anthony Shadid. His colleagues were lining up to call him the most gifted foreign correspondent in a generation.
I knew him only through his work, not personally, and I'm moved, of course, by the testimonials of his friends and colleagues. This is a reminder of what he has done over the last two decades of his reportage from the Middle East, of what journalistic organizations can do. They train people. He was trained in Arabic. They send them around the world to help us understand the evolution of the world, and that is something he did masterfully, and it's a loss to everyone that he has died.
That's Jim Fallows. He's national correspondent with The Atlantic. You can read his blog at jamesfallows.theatlantic.com. Jim, thanks very much.
My pleasure.